For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good evening. It's my pleasure to introduce Zenshin Florence Kaplow, our speaker this evening. Florence used to sit in with me at my group in California before I moved to Chicago in Bolinas, the Mountain Source Sangha. She had been professionally a conservation botanist for the state of Washington, and then became an environmental activist. I believe that included being in kayaks outside Seattle, blocking tanker ships. And Florence also was at Standing Rock, supporting the indigenous water protectors. Florence is, in addition to being a Zen priest in Tsuki Roshi lineage, is also a Unitarian Universalist minister, currently the minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Champaign. And she's also co-edited this wonderful book called The Hidden Lamp, co-edited with my friend Sue Moon. There are numbers of good books now about women in Buddhism, but this is my favorite. It has stories about the history of women Buddhist teachers and great practitioners from India, China, Korea, Japan, and the West. Especially wonderful are the commentaries on those stories from modern contemporary women Buddhist teachers. It's an important book, and particularly timely now as women's rights are at stake now this week in our country in Washington. So Florence is going to talk about some of the great women in the Zen tradition.
Good evening, everyone. Some of you I met 4.5 years ago when I was last here. I was traveling around the country with my co-editor, Sue Moon, although I was the only one who came here, and I felt very warmly welcomed. It was lovely to be here. So it's nice to be back. And I really want to thank Taigen for inviting me here. I've only been back in the Midwest for about a year, and one of the things that felt like a good part of coming back to the Midwest, where I grew up, was that I knew that I would only be 2 hours from this wonderful sangha and wonderful teacher and old friend. Taiga and I also practiced together at Green Gulch Farm a few years before that. I don't know. Time gets a little blurry back in those days. Anyway, it's wonderful to be here and to have a chance to speak with you. If you can't hear me, just raise your hand. I have a because I'm a minister, I have a pretty good carrying voice, but I want to make sure that everybody's able to hear, so don't be shy if you're having trouble hearing me. I am going to share some stories from the book today, and a particular set of stories. And when Taigen and I were talking about what, he asked me what I wanted to explore with you, and there will be time for some questions and answers afterwards as well. I had no idea that I felt this draw to bring to you the stories of the samurai women from this book. And they are particularly strong and fierce in a book that is full of some rather strong and fierce women. And it feels like this is good energy to bring to all of us right now with what has been happening nationally, and not just nationally, but I know from my role as a minister what has been happening in the hearts of many, many people, both women and men, in response to what we've been witnessing. I'll warn you that some of these stories might be a little shocking if any of you are squeamish. You might just be aware that there will be some fairly wild and explicit material in these stories. Yeah, at least R. We might even be headed further over. One of the things that if you know something about the history of Zen, you know that Zen does have this very, the koans have this very earthy quality, some of them. And the stories about women particularly are often stories of the body. It's part of what I love about these stories is that they don't leave out the body. I'll just say a little bit about the book, just for those of you who may not be aware of it. This book began out of my own search for women's wisdom within my tradition. And I'm a pretty well-trained Zen person, hanging around Zen Center for a while, and my longtime teacher was Oketsu Norman Fisher, who's a wonderful scholar and traditionally based teacher, who does teach from the koans. But like many fairly well-trained Zen people, I knew some koans about women, maybe 4 or 5. And yet I could see that the Dharma in a woman's form, I knew enough to know that it's been present since the time of the Buddha. I was watching women Zen teachers arise out of the traditional training, and this was new. I've met people who began practicing Zen in the 60s. I met someone on almost right at the beginning when we started traveling around with the book, and she said, I began practicing Zen in 1965, and it wasn't until 1985 that I ever saw a woman in the teacher's seat. 20 years of practice and never seeing a woman in the teacher's seat. Things have changed a little. I think this is a good thing. But still, it's pretty new. And I needed these stories for myself, and so I began searching for them, looking through the collections, looking online, seeing where I could find stories of women's awakening, women's encounters with each other and with men. And when I got to 75 stories, I felt like this needs to be shared in some way. And at that point, I reached out to our mutual friend, Sue Moon, who's also a Dharma sister of mine, a wonderful writer, editor. And I said, Sue, I think I might have a big project. Would you be interested in working with me? And what we wanted to do was really recreate the form of some of the traditional koan collections, like the Blue Cliff Record. And so we decided we'd have 100 koans with 100 different women, each writing a reflection on a koan. Some of these are traditional koans, even in the classic koan collections. Others are from the time of the Buddha, as I said, the nuns that studied with the Buddha. Some are even stories from the pioneering 20th century Western women who first started teaching the Dharma here, people like Joko Beck and Maureen Stewart and others. Also to say that this is not a traditional approach to koans that we find in some of the Zen schools, like the Rinzai schools and the Korean Zen school, where when I go around and teach these, I really want them to come alive in a group setting where we can explore them together. So this will be pretty conversational rather than formal. All right, well, let's dive in to the samurai women I'm going to be talking about a series of stories that all take place in the same area of Japan, in the same city of Japan, over a couple of hundred years. And this place was called Tokeiji. It's still called Tokeiji. It still exists. And it's in the city of Kamakura, which was the center of, if you know anything about Japanese history, you know that there was a time in medieval Japan where, although there was an emperor, the real power was held by the samurai families, and especially the shogun, who was the primary, you could say, warlord of that time. And that power was based in Kamakura, which is a beautiful historic city on the eastern coastline of Japan. And this was the center of Rinzai Zen. There are two major, major schools of Zen in Japan, Soto Zen, we come from that tradition, and Rinzai Zen. And Kamakura and the warrior culture of Kamakura was naturally attracted to the intensity and warrior feeling of Rinzai. Sometimes it's said that Soto Zen is farmer Zen. It's kind of boring. We just sit around together. But that Rinzai Zen is warrior Zen. And this is very early in the time of Zen even coming to Japan. It's about 13th century was when all this began to happen in Kamakura. And Tokeiji, which is a nunnery just for women, was founded in 1285. Founded by a woman whose name was Kakuzan Shido, who was the widow of one of the shoguns. Therefore, at one point, she would have been the most powerful woman in Japan. And she was raised in a samurai family. When her husband died at 33, her husband was known as a ruthless leader, military leader, she chose to ordain. She studied at a male Rinzai monastery, also in Kamakura, called Engakuji, which also still exists, is still a living place of Zen practice. At the time, there were about 1,000 monks there, and it was known as one of the most ferocious, rough places to practice Zen anywhere. And that's where she chose to go and practice Zen. That gives you a little sense of what her character might have been like. And before I say more, I think I'm just going to share a story of her, just to give you a little flavor of who she was. And then I'll tell you more about Tokeiji. This is a story called Kakuzan Shido's Dagger. Page 131 of the book. And this is in a collection of koans from this period. And one of the things I find really interesting is that the Japanese, when the Chinese koans started coming into Japan, were just as mystified by them as we are. They didn't know all the Chinese references and the literary references, and they weren't steeped in Zen in the way that Japanese culture was later steeped in Zen, and so they were just, it was just impossible for them. And so, just as Western teachers now have put together collections of koans for Westerners, the Japanese teachers did the same thing, and they were taken from the lives of Japanese practitioners. And that's where this story comes from. Oh, let's see, I guess I have the wrong page here. Jesus. So you have to imagine, this woman was the most powerful woman in Japan. Then her husband died. She has chosen to practice Zen in this rather terrifying place as perhaps the only woman in this place of 1,000 monks. And she's about to be given Dharma transmission, full recognition of her capacity as a teacher. From what I've read, she may have only been the second Zen woman within the Rinzai tradition to be given Dharma transmission in all of Japan. The nun, Kakuzan Chido, trained at the notoriously tough Rinzai monastery in Gakuji. Her teacher, Tokei, whose name meant peach tree valley, gave her Inka, transmission and authority to be an independent teacher. In the transmission ceremony, Chido took the seat in front of the altar, and the monks asked her questions to test her skill. When it was the head monk's turn, he challenged her. In our lineage, anyone who receives Inka must give a discourse on the sutras. Are you really capable of doing this? Chido pulled out the 10-inch dagger carried by all women of the warrior class and held it in front of his face. Every Zen teacher in the lineage of our master should teach the sutras, she said. But I am a woman of the warrior line, and I speak the Dharma face to face with my dagger drawn. What need do I have for books? He persisted with another question. I'm just trying to imagine pulling out a 10-inch dagger from underneath my robes. It's a little shocking. Somehow you would think that they would give that up when they ordained, but apparently Kakuzan had not. He persisted with another question, or maybe she needed to have that 10-inch dagger because of where she was practicing. He persisted with another question. What was your original understanding before your parents were born? She answered by sitting in silence with her eyes closed. Then she said, "Do you understand?" The head monk answered with a verse. "Here in Peachtree Valley, a wine gourd has been drained to the last drop. Drunken eyes see 10 miles of flowers." Which I think meant he approved. That gives you a little flavor of this woman, who she was, what it took to be that kind of pioneer in that time and place. And the nunnery she founded was one of only two places in Japan which were sanctuaries for women. At that time in Japan, and for hundreds of years afterward, no woman could separate or leave her husband under any circumstances, including severe spousal abuse. There was no way to be free, except if you could get to one of the two temples in the country and get through the gate of the temple and stay there. Originally, it was 3 years at Tokeji, and later it was 1 year. If you stayed for that amount of time, you didn't have to ordain, but if you stayed inside that gate for that amount of time, you were free from your marriage. And I wanted to share with you that a few years ago, way after this book came out, I had a chance to go to Kamakura and go to Tokeji, which, as I said, still exists as a sub-temple of Engakuji, which is very close by. And I saw the gate that the women would need to enter in order to be safe. And it's a very unpretentious gate. It has the straw roof, like many traditional gates in Japan. It's the kind of thing that a guy on a war horse could knock over pretty easily. And yet, for 600 years, no man entered the gates of Tokeji. And in fact, there are stories of women and children being pursued by small armies as they ran to the gates of Tokeji. And when the warriors got to that gate, to that very small gate, they did not go through. No woman was ever removed from Tokeji in those 600 years. You can see why I thought this might be relevant for our current situation here. I have some photographs from my time there, so I thought I might pass these around. We will start with the gate. I think I have a photo of the gate. Yes, here we go. Actually, it's got a very long staircase, but the top is, we'll just pass this around. I realize this is untraditional, but so what? And I'll also pass around a little 19th century drawing of Tokeji. You'll see that it's very small. There couldn't have been more than probably less than 100 women there at any one time. One thing to mention about this place is later, after it was no longer a women's monastery, it became a very important place for some of the people who brought Zen to the West. And in the cemetery there, which I'll tell you more about, the graves of D.T. Suzuki and his wife, Beatrice Suzuki, who lived at Tokeji towards the end of their lives, and R.H. Blythe, who was the person who brought us the haiku tradition from Japan, some of the first translations of haiku, are all buried there at Tokeji in that very beautiful cemetery. So, as I said, this was about 1285 when Kakuzan Shido first founded this place for women's practice. And it's just across a little valley and a bridge over a small river from Engakuji, from this massive, very, very important Rinzai monastery. And in fact, I have a picture of Tokeji taken from Engakuji, and you can see how close it really is. It would probably be about a 5, maybe 7 minute walk from one place to the other. As time went on, and these women were practicing in the way that they were so close by, there had been this tradition that women would go over to Engakuji to hear Dharma talks and to practice there. But it appears that this became more threatening to the monks over time, and they started making it harder and harder for women to enter that important place of practice. And one of the ways that they made that difficult was by being outrageous to any woman who tried to come in. And I'll read you a story about that. This is not from Tokeji, but it is a woman who came from another monastery, a Soto monastery, also in Kamakura, to go to Engakuji. It's called Eshun's Deep Thing. It'll give you a little sense of why women might have been, many women, uncomfortable practicing there. Eshun was a nun at the monastery at Saijoji. The abbot of Saijoji wanted to send a message to the abbot of the great temple of Engakuji, which was known for its rough treatment of outsiders. None of the monks from Saijoji dared to go, because apparently if the monks went, they were often beaten up by the monks at Engakuji. But only Eshun, who was a nun, was willing to volunteer. When the Engakuji monks saw her walk through the main gate, one of them rushed forward, raised his robes to expose himself, and said, "This monk's thing is 3 feet long. How about it?" Eshun calmly lifted her robes, spread her legs, and said, "This nun's thing is infinitely deep." She dropped her robes and continued down the corridor unmolested. That's a pretty extraordinary story in terms of women's courage, women's power, and women's practice. Again, as time went on and feelings about women changed in terms of their right to practice, one of the things the monks at Engakuji started doing was that to get through the gate of Engakuji, in order to go hear a Dharma talk there, if you were female, you had to pass a koan at the gate. There was a gatekeeper. He would ask the woman a question. If he didn't think that woman had a deep enough answer to the question, you didn't get to come in and hear the Dharma talk. Okay. I'll tell you a little bit about how one woman responded to that particular challenge. I know this might be a little shocking. We're such nice Soto Zen people. This seems pretty wild. But these were samurai people. These were warrior people. And part of the reason they were practicing Zen was to develop fearlessness. And I think, although we don't talk about it so much within Soto, there is an element where we are also practicing to develop fearlessness, to develop the capacity to meet the situation that we are presented with courage and compassion and clarity and freshness. And we can learn from these women, even though we might not be willing or wanting to be in the situations that these women placed themselves within. They were determined to practice, and no one was going to stop them. This is a story from the 14th century, so about 100 years later. And it's called Yoshihime's Look Look. Yoshihime was a nun at Tokeji and the daughter of a general. She was very strong, and her nickname was Devil Girl. She wanted to meet with the teacher at the monastery of Engakuji, but the gatekeeper monk barred her way with a shout. "What is it, the gate through which the Buddhas come into the world?" Yoshihime grabbed his head and forced it between her legs, saying, "Look, look." The monk said, "In the middle, there is a fragrance of wind and dew." Yoshihime said, "This monk, he's not fit to keep the gate. He ought to be looking after the garden." The gatekeeper ran into the temple and reported this to the teacher's attendant, who said, "Let me test her." So the attendant went to the gate and asked her again, "What is it, the gate through which the Buddhas come into the world?" Yoshihime grabbed his head and held it between her legs, saying, "Look, look." The attendant said, "The Buddhas of the three worlds come giving light." Yoshihime said, "This monk is the one with the eye. He saw the 84,000 gates all thrown open." And to really understand this story, you have to understand another story that comes from China hundreds of years before. And I'll share that with you. Let's see if I can find the page here. Which was a story that all of these people would have known. And in fact, the question the monk asked is from this koan, which is called Miao Zhong's Dharma Interview. And this is from, as I said, several hundred years before. "Before Miao Zhong became a nun, she used to visit Master Dahui Shangzhao's monastery to study with him. and he gave her her room in the abbot's quarters. The senior monk, Wanan, did not approve. Dahui said to him, although she's a woman, she has outstanding merits. Wanan still disapproved. He didn't like that a woman was being treated as an honored guest in his monastery. So Dahui urged him to have an interview with Miao Zhang. Wanan reluctantly agreed and requested an interview. Miao Zhang said, do you want a Dharma interview or a worldly interview? A Dharma interview, replied Wanan. Miao Zhang said, then send your attendants away. She went into the room first, and after a few moments, she called, please come in. When Wanan entered, he saw Miao Zhang lying naked on her back on the bed. He pointed at her genitals, saying, what is this place? Miao Zhang replied, all the Buddhas of the three worlds, the six patriarchs, and all great monks everywhere come out of this place. You follow. You see the connection between this and look, look. Where do the Buddhas come from? Wanan said, and may I enter? I told you, this gets a little racy. Miao Zhang replied, horses may cross, asses may not. Wanan was unable to reply. Miao Zhang declared, I have met you, senior monk. The interview is over. She turned her back to him. Wanan left, ashamed. Later, Dahui said to him, the old dragon has some wisdom, doesn't she? And remember, the question that the gatekeeper asked at Engaku-ji was, what is it, the gate through which the Buddhas come into the world? And I love, one of the things I love about this story is that the gatekeeper is there to keep her out. He asks her a question about another kind of gate, and she shows him. But then she's not satisfied with his answer. She turns the thing completely around and sends him off to find somebody who can really meet her. And then when he does, then she is the one who says, yes, you have the understanding. Which, I don't know, I just... these women being willing to enter into these places of such male power and male violence, and meet it in this way. When Taigen and I were talking earlier today about the events in Washington, D.C., and Taigen was mentioning about the, I don't know if this was exactly the words he used, but I'll use some Zen words, the uprightness of Christine Blasey Ford, her dignity, her clarity. In a way, what Christine Blasey Ford did, she walked into the through the gates of the temple of power in this country. And she stood there face to face with the gatekeepers. And she met them. She met them with power and grace and vulnerability and wisdom. So don't think that this isn't happening right here and now as well as 800 years ago. In fact, I want to share a little from the commentary to Kakuzan Chido's Dagger because it's an important story that also takes place pretty much right now. We called these reflections rather than commentaries. This one was written by Laura Del Valle, who is also a Dharma sister of mine, who is a doctor in a clinic, a free clinic in Mexico. She is Mexican. And she lives and works in this community. She is a Zen teacher. You may have heard of a place. There's a place that she runs called Mar de Jade, where you can go and actually do Zen Sesshin. and the money that you spend to go there, she uses to support this clinic. And that's the work she does. And this is her story that I wanted to share. Like Kakazan, I was born into a line of women warriors. My grandmother and mother were immigrant women in the U.S. who, as single mothers, became fearless for the sake of their children. Although I was raised in Mexico City and Chicago, I ended up living and working as a doctor in rural Mexico, where many single mothers struggle for the survival of their children. Isabel came to my clinic for help. She was a thin woman in her late 20s who held one hand over her mouth when she spoke to cover her few decaying teeth. She said softly, "Adam has taken the three children to live with his new prostitute girlfriend. I want them back." Adam had once hung her upside down from a tree. She didn't ask me directly for fear of losing hope. A long silence followed. We both knew that going to the law was useless. Adam, the father of her children, was a hardcore drug dealer who was off limits to the state prosecutor and local police. My mind was racing. I told myself, "You're a doctor, not a cop. You have no magic powers. You're not a tough guy with a gun. So just what do you think you can do?" Isabel was looking at the ground despondently. I said, "Get in the car and let's go get them." Adam wasn't home, and the girlfriend turned over the kids without resistance. An hour later, Adam was at the clinic looking for me. Isabel and the kids hid. I came out to meet him. Once the knife is drawn, there's no turning back. The knife demands that you pay total attention to whatever unfolds. We stared at each other for a long time, both of us breathing heavily, before he spoke. "I should kill you, but you're a decent woman. You fed my children, and I don't kill decent people." He left. Shortly afterwards, he did kill someone, and he was finally sent to jail because the victim's parents had enough money and connections to go beyond the local authorities. Part of what I see in Kakazan Shido and that I see in Laura de Valle is this quality of courage and fearlessness, not for the sake of violence, but for the sake of protection. To protect the vulnerable. To protect women who are in danger. And I love that there was this place of women's practice that also functioned in that way for so many years. I'm going to read another story. I'm going to kind of leave the really intense warrior stories, give you all a little break, because that wasn't all that happened there. This really was also a place of very, very deep and sincere women's practice. And this is a story that is quite moving to me, partly because it's about mirrors. And I think that we have complicated relationships with mirrors as women. The convent of Tokeji had a great mirror. The founding abbess Kakazan Shido would meditate before it in order to see into her own nature. So for all these years, there was a mirror in the zendo at Tokeji. Imagine that instead of facing the wall, you're facing a mirror as you sit zazen. That was one of the practices at Tokeji. And the other thing is, of course, that a mirror in Japan at the time was both an extremely valuable object, but also a very, very sacred object. When I was last in Japan, I was spending time in a Shinto shrine, and the mirror is one of the most sacred symbols in Shinto. So to look into a mirror as you practice zazen is to look into both the most sacred, but also the biggest question. Who is it that is looking into that mirror? Later generations of nuns would practice zazen in front of the mirror, concentrating on the question, where is a single feeling, a single thought in the mirror image at which I gaze? Each abbess of Tokeji wrote a verse in response to the mirror practice. The following verse was composed by the fifth abbess, Princess Yodo. Heart unclouded, heart clouded, standing or falling, it is still the same body. And perhaps one more. That one of the things about Tokeji is it became a place where the nuns could wear purple. Purple was the color of the imperial family. And over the centuries, there were a number of women of the imperial family who ordained there. And so it was considered an imperial convent. Do you all do a Buddha's birthday or a Buddha's birthday ceremony here with the flowers? Okay, so did they. And they were famous for their celebrations. The nuns of Tokeji were famous for their beautiful and elaborate flower decorations on Buddha's birthday. Master Yodo, the abbess of Tokeji, and a former imperial princess wrote a verse for this occasion. Decorate the heart of the beholder, for the Buddha of the flower hall is nowhere else. Her attendants also wrote verses. Ika, a former court lady, wrote, throw away into the street the years of the past. What is born now on the flower dais, let it raise its newborn cry. And I'm conscious a little of the time. How are we doing?
We'll do another story or two, but that's maybe that's
okay. Okay. One of the things that happened for me when I went to Tokeji is that, as I said, it was quite profound for me to be there. It's the only place of practice from the book that, as far as I know, still exists. And then, so to be able to go into that gate, to be able to stand in this place of women's enlightenment, of women's depth of practice, of women's courage, was very powerful. And they have a little museum there. And I went into the museum and I took a photograph of that that old etching of Tokeji. And the woman behind the desk spoke a little bit of English and we began talking. And I told her that I had written this book and that I had all these stories from Tokeji in the book. And she said, oh, have you gone to the cemetery yet? And I said, no, I didn't know there was a cemetery here. And she said, oh, you must go. And she pulled out a map of the cemetery. And she said, what were the names of the women that were in your book? And I said, oh, Kakusan Shido and Princess Yodo. And I named and Yozen, which that'll be the last story I'll tell you. And she said, oh, you can go to their graves. And she showed me on the map where their ashes were in the cemetery. And I'm going to pass around three images from the cemetery. The first, you'll see two caves. And in one of those caves is the grave of Kakusan Shido. And in the other cave is the grave of Princess Yodo. And there are fresh flowers in front of them. To this day, they are still honored. Women come from all over Japan to honor the women of Tokeji. So I'll pass this around. And then the second photograph is inside one of the caves. And it is the very simple stupa of Kakusan Shido. And then the final photograph that you'll see looks like a whole long line of memorial stones. These are the abbesses of Tokeji over the first few hundred years. And to stand there in that beautiful cemetery with old growth trees all around and look at these stones, knowing that beneath each stone were the ashes of another awakened woman teacher, was beyond powerful for me as a woman practitioner in 21st century America. And while I was there, I kept thinking of this story, because this takes place right at Tokeji. Nyozen was, again, a slightly later woman who practiced there. And what's interesting about this story is that she meditated on a previous enlightenment story of another Japanese woman. So by this time, the stories of women's awakenings were being meditated upon by other women. And then that was leading to their awakenings, like the candle flame being passed from one candle to another. The nun Nyozen of Tokeji used to meditate on the enlightenment poem of Chiyono as her theme for realization, who became Mugai Nyodai, who was the first woman to receive Dharma transmission as a Zen teacher in Japan. With this and that, I tried to keep the bucket together, and then the bottom fell out. Where water does not collect, the moon does not dwell. Later, Nyozen grasped the essence of Zen, and she presented this poem to her teacher. The bottom fell out of the bucket of that woman of humble birth. The pale moon of dawn is caught in the rain puddles. And as I walked the paths of Tokeji, I thought, on one of these paths, there were puddles of water in the 13th century, and a woman had a moment of awakening right here where I'm standing right now. And I hope that in hearing these stories, hearing them orally in the way that really stories are meant to be heard, a little bit of the wildness and fearlessness and gentleness and power of these women has entered your heart in some small way. And with that, anything anyone would like to bring up? Including, wow, that made me really uncomfortable. Anything goes. Yes.
Thank you very much for coming to the talk. I'm just curious, are there still or are there many nuns in Japan?
Very few. There is one Soto Zen place in Nagoya that's quite famous, and in fact there's been a book written about it, where nuns are doing very, very, very sincere Soto Zen practice. I'm not aware of any Rinzai place of practice for women. One of the interesting things in Japan is that men who are ordained marry and have families, which is very unusual in the Western world. The women in Japan, over and over again, have come together and decided that they did not want to marry, that they wanted to remain celibate monastics. And I think part of that is because they recognize that as women, if they did marry, the likelihood that they would be able to fully manifest their path would be changed. And so they continue to be a celibate orders. But there are very few of them. And I think, as in many parts of Asia, they are not necessarily, they don't receive the same kinds of funding and support. It's tough. And they don't, women generally are not priests of temples in the way that men are. And that's where a big source of income comes in Japan, is from the funerals in the temples. So it's hard for women. Do you have anything to add? Have you met women in Japan who were nuns?
I've met American women teachers who studied Nalayama Rishi and Nibbaya. There are American women who are going and studying with nuns in Japan. The temple wives in Japan are a whole class of really amazing people. Going back to Suzuki Roshi's widow, son, who stayed at San Francisco Zen Center for decades after he passed and was really an inspiration.
She was also a very, very wonderful haiku poet. And you can, there are several collections of her poetry available. They're very deep.
But there are traditions of the shomyo, the baika singing that are done by Soto women. So that there is a amongst the parishioners in Zen, many women who are organized into many functions. But I'm not sure about women teachers in Japan. There are not so many. But there were some women in a couple of the months.
There's a very interesting book. Now I'm forgetting her name. Maybe you can help me. But the woman who wrote the book on the monastery at Nagoya also wrote a book called Zen at Home, which is about the practice of lay women in lay Zen women in Japan.
Paulo Arai,
thank you. Yes. Other questions, thoughts? Yes, please.
Stories are so rich as they fermented over so many centuries, right? And you've kind of told the story of Dr. Ford and kind of contextualized it in a mythological way, which, you know, and that, so I'm just thinking that our minds are so literal, you know, like our, we don't, you know, everything's going to be digital, and so how will stories ferment over time, you know, when our histories are so documented? They're just literal, they're not imaginative.
Well, for one thing, I think these are real stories. Not all the stories in the book are necessarily, but my sense is these happened. A lot of the koans are, we know that they happened because actually someone wrote them down at the time. For instance, that story of Miao Zhang Starmer interview, the one with, we know about that story because Wanan, the guy who got really embarrassed, actually wrote it in his own record of his life and teachings. He became a teacher later. And so these stories very likely happened something like this. And I think we are still telling those stories. My guess is if we went around the room here, and those of you who've been around Taigen for a while, that there'd be some stories about Taigen and his encounters with people that maybe even just get told kind of casually. Oh, you remember that time? I have some of those from Norman. Oh, that time that we had a person at Green Gulch who went completely psychotic and nobody knew what to do until finally somebody woke up Norman and he showed up and he put his arms around her and she broke down in his arms crying. But before that, no one could get near her. That's a story that students of Norman's tell. And that's exactly how these happened in the same way. So I have a feeling it doesn't matter how digital we get. We'll still be telling stories because that is the nature of humans. There's a, has David Loy ever come here?
He has been here.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of David Loy. And one of the things he says is, you know, the world is made of stories. And I think that's true. And that's one of the reasons that stories are, what stories we choose to tell and what stories we hide, this is why it was called the hidden lamp, because these stories were there but forgotten, really matter in terms of what we believe is possible. So I don't know if that's helpful, but I think we'll still be telling stories even when we're all replaced by robots or whatever. Any other thoughts? I think I saw someone, please.
If you could have been there and seen the women's testimony, you would have been really inspired. The women who objected to this change were fierce. There's just no other word for it. And their language was very, very strong. Some of them were doctors who had patients who were thoracic patients. There was a man also who had thoracic patients. They were enraged, and they were verbal, and they didn't pull any punches. And I couldn't help but think about them when we were talking about these fierce women, because I saw six or seven of them today, and it was a very, very interesting thing to see. I felt the women's testimony was, maybe it's because I'm a woman, but I felt the women's testimony was much more, had a lot more punch than the men's did. I don't know, I could be wrong about that. There were some men who were very angry, but they were more conforming and controlled than the women were not. It was really interesting.
I know that, I think a lot of people might think that, thank you for sharing that, actually. It's a powerful story. I think a lot of people kind of think that women, like maybe women's wisdom or women's practice would be kind of sweet and compassionate and gentle and kind, all these images we have of women. And the funny thing is, when I start working on these stories, I'm like, there isn't a single one in that category. And I think it's partly because it takes something to do this practice. If you've done this for any length of time, you know this is not easy practice that we do. It's not easy being human, actually. That takes quite a bit right there. One of the things a friend once said, looking at people at San Francisco Zen Center, is that it seemed like when people had been doing Zen practice for a long, long time, that the men got a little softer from that practice, a little more gentle. And the women got stronger, as if it was a balancing of what we have in us that is all genders, and that this practice, which is a practice of such uncompromising self-honesty, helps us to be able to be wider than just those poles that people live in. Anything else?
Yes.
Yes, please.
All of them in my family carry daggers.
What was that?
All women in my family carry daggers. I mean, they're dagger women.
Uh-huh.
I grew up in a matriarchal family. And also in commercial construction, many private families are women. I think the prejudice is that there's an organizational level of detail and a anti-politic and anti-politic that women are better, which is, I suppose, a discriminatory statement, but for better still that. Writing, women writers in the faith tradition are still relatively rare in terms of commentary on ecology and so forth.
Would I say that? There are a lot. I mean, one of the things that Sue noticed when we worked on this book is that had we been doing it even 10 years before, we might have had trouble finding 100 women. We had no trouble finding 100 women. In fact, we could have easily had 200 women. The book's been published in German, and there were a whole set of German teachers that added their reflections to these. In other words, with every passing year, there are more women stepping forward and sharing.
And can I just respond to that? I think there is a genuine, measurable progress in recent centuries that is unlike prior centuries. You leave writers Emily Dickinson, Virginia Woolf, George Eliot, and others, you can't find examples of women writers prior to 1820. It's very difficult. And now there's, so I think there's hope. It's good. The landscape is that's, you know, even though we have these outrages that are in the political realm, it's really archaic, almost relevant. What's actually going on is measurable in American culture, I think, almost maybe somewhere, is the intellectual culture.
This is total editorializing on my part, so forgive me. But I went to very, very progressive seminaries where part of what we did is really study how social change happens. And one of the understandings within looking at how social change happens is just at the point when a previously oppressed group is really coming out of that is when the violence and attacks get really intense. And I think about that with these stories of Engakuji and the gatekeepers, right? That as these women became more prominent, the you must stay out got more and more outrageous. And I think we're seeing that right now in our country, that in fact this is a sign of how powerful women are becoming, that now they're a genuine threat. And we're going to stop this, whatever we have to do. And personally, I don't think it's going to work. I think it's too late. I talk to me privately about revolution. So I'll just say that.
We'll have time for just individual discussion. Just two things in response to Ed. One is just to say that there are many, many, many really fine American women Zen teachers now. And the next generation will be. Yeah, that's happening. And then just in response to Jan's story about the women in Chicago today, the two women who confronted Senator Flake in the elevator.
Might have changed history.
Yeah. Very beautiful and powerful. And fierce. We have our stories.
We have our stories, yes.
Any last comments before we do the Bodhisattva vows? Okay, let's chant the four Bodhisattva vows.